Okay, please give a warm welcome to our speaker tonight, Nick from the Cornerstone Home Group.
Yes, Nick! Woo!
Yeah! All right, I'm an alcoholic, my name's Nick. I want to thank David M., who isn't here tonight. He actually called me on the way for the opportunity to come here and share my experience so far. Up to this point, I have a sobriety date, April 21st, 2023. I have a home group, Cornerstone Group in Norfolk. We meet on Saturdays at 7 p.m. It's a big book study. My goal tonight is to, I hope to leave here and to help somebody, anybody. I hope I get to meet some new people, connect with some new people, and connect with some old friends. I've been struggling and trying to solve the riddle of alcoholism, it seems like, all my life. I tried so many different things, over and over and over again to get me to Alcoholics Anonymous. I had to do everything possible to get me to the solution. For me, the only thing that has solved my problem of alcoholism. I grew up right here in Virginia Beach, or not here, but in Virginia Beach up the road, to a loving family. I had three siblings. I grew up with a stepfather. My parents were both in the Navy, so I had some nice structure growing up. I didn't know much about my real dad. All I knew was he wasn't around because of alcohol. And so for that, I considered alcohol as evil and bad, and I tried to stay away from it as long as I could. But I always felt, you know, even before alcohol, I felt different, even in my house, only one with my last name. Was a very shy kid growing up, very uncomfortable around people, you know, always kind of curious and trying to figure out what people were thinking of me. We joked when we were earlier before the meeting, when I'm introducing myself, I usually forget someone's name because I'm so concerned about what they're thinking of me.
Around 16, my first love in life, my first purpose in life was sports. I played baseball particularly. It was my way to connect. I felt like it was my reason to live, you know. I really enjoyed it. It was how I met a majority of my friends. At the age of 16, I was on a cruise ship with my family vacation. My brother just turned 21, and there was an opportunity to drink alcohol. He had a bottle of Jim Beam. My parents, for some reason, thought it was a good idea to give me and my brother their own room on a cruise ship. He just turned 21. And my mom gave me all this liquor, or my brother all this liquor, and my mom had a different strategy. She thought the kid would not crave the forbidden fruit, so she kind of, I wouldn't say she encouraged it, but she let me, you know, kind of explore those things. And I remember I was by myself, I filled up a water bottle just like this, a Jim Beam, not knowing what it'd do to me. I was by myself, and I remember drinking, I wouldn't say all of it, but I drank it, and I remember the feeling I had. I remember walking through that cruise ship, you know, just feeling light, quieted my mind, I knew I was going to be doing that again. Within a year of that first drink, you know, I was roughly 16, 17, I got arrested for I was driving under the influence, 0.23, as a 17-year-old. On a school night, I had high school baseball uniform on. I somehow was in bars that night. My buddy had a fake ID. And apparently, you're supposed to go to mandatory 10 days jail. Fortunate for me and my older brother, my dad was a police officer in Virginia Beach. And so all through my early days of high school, I kind of got off the hook on a lot of things. But I didn't get charged with a DUI, but I got introduced to ASAP. So there was some consequences very early on. I got introduced to ASAP, and I had to do a couple of AA meetings, I think Moms Against Drunk Driving. At that moment in time, I felt it was just something I had to do. I had no interest in quitting alcohol or trying to, you know, it was just something I had to do. And, you know, those early days of drinking, I think were kind of scary in terms of I didn't really know the power of alcohol in terms of consumption and what it would do to me. So early on, it was very common to have, you know, alcohol poisoning or some weird blackouts or, so that was happening right away in terms of alcohol. Again, alcohol was in my body, I kept going. When I feel that feeling of alcohol, I want to feel that as long as humanly possible, and that's always been my reaction. So again, in high school, you know, again, baseball is my life at this point. It's the only reason I kind of pay attention in school. I end up going to college right here in Norfolk, or up the street in Norfolk. I had some opportunities to go elsewhere, but I was just so scared to go outside my comfort zone. That's my life, is being in a comfort zone, whatever that may be. And so I went up right up to Norfolk. I knew it was going to be close to home. And right away, I got in a lot of trouble instantly on academic probation after my first semester. Because in college, I could really pay attention to other people and see how they were drinking. A lot of people were drinking like me, but they had the ability to shut it down when they needed to. They had the ability to buckle down or, you know, kind of slow it down. For me, I just never could, really. It just kept progressively getting worse. You know, I ended up kind of buckling down a little bit on grades. I kind of get the heat off of me. Again, baseball at this point is my primary purpose in life. Junior year comes around, my drinking is progressively getting worse. I get introduced to, you know, some stuff that helps me stay focused in school and drink more, and that was just escalating my drinking. By the time I'm 22, 21, I'm starting to drink every day. I'm starting to drink towards life. I'm drinking alcohol to walk life out, and that's a big problem for me, because when I start doing that, once I don't drink, it seems impossible task to do in terms of picking up the phone or any of the menial tasks of living life. I can't seem to do sober, and alcohol seemed to kind of get me propelled and moving in that direction. I don't know what it is, but alcohol seemed to get me moving in the beginning. By the time I'm 22 or 21, 22, I ended up having a shoulder injury that basically, and at that moment in time, I thought it ruined my career. But again, a normal person would rehab and redshirt and do all these things. I just didn't. It just seemed like too hard of a thing to do. I just quit. I stopped going to school. And again, once baseball was pulled from me, alcohol started coming into my life even more. At this point in time, my mother was getting sick, dying of cancer. And so watching her die was more drinking for me. I remember on her last day in her hospice, I thought she was going to come out. She never told us that she was dying of terminal cancer. None of the kids knew she was dying. I don't know if it would have made a difference, but my last time I saw her, I went in hospice drunk. That point, alcohol was taking a different role in my life. I couldn't handle it. And alcohol seemed, as crazy as that sounds, seems my only way to handle life. And she ended up passing. At this moment in time, I had a blackout incident where I ended up waking up in the hospital. I was drinking and taking prescription drugs, and the doctors in there, they noticed I have part of my heart's damaged. Again, I was doing a lot of other stuff, including alcohol, that was damaged my heart. And any normal person, that'd be good enough reason to quit, to shut it down. Not for me. I kept continuing to drink. Again, at this point, 23, I have nothing going on in my life. At this point, I've lost my mother. She ended up passing. I lost baseball. So again, I'm losing all these things, these things that are kind of directing me and guiding me through life, kind of keep me on a straight and narrow. Once these things start falling apart, alcohol starts taking a whole new role in my life. And, you know, I ended up waking up one night or one morning. Again, I had this idea that my heart's messed up. I have a damaged heart. I think I'm having a heart attack. I'm scared to death. I'm shaking. And I call 911 on myself. You know, I need help. You know, I was that scared for my life. I need help. And I get rushed to the emergency room. And I'm honest with the lady. You know, she gives me 30 days of withdrawal medicine from alcohol. And, you know, I at this point, I know alcohol was killing me, and this was the opportunity to get separated from it. I did the medicine for 30 days, and to kind of speed up the story, I ended up going 10 years separated or dry from alcohol, not knowing any idea of, you know, the disease of alcoholism. Very early on, I did a lot of things to kind of stay sober or stay dry. First of all, I had a very difficult problem with people and relationships. I isolated a lot. I drank isolated. I did a lot of gym. I got to the gym. I started doing a lot of gym stuff. I started a career in hospitality, not because I like restaurants or hotels. It's simply I started that job there and I never left out of fear of trying something new. I ended up staying in the hotel business for, you know, roughly 10 years. You know, my ability to kind of, you know, whoever I'm working with, I watch you and I pay attention to how you operate, especially my bosses. I know, and I adjust to that. You know, I have the ability to adjust, and that's how I was able to climb through the ranks of a big company at the oceanfront. But honestly, I was not good at my work. I looked good in a suit, and I was charming. That's why I was not good. I was lazy. So around year five, something's still wrong. You know, I thought alcohol was my problem. I'm at this point, anxiety's through the roof, my depression. I'm just moping through life, and something's not right. I don't know what's wrong with me. I thought alcohol was my problem, and I go and I get on a bunch of medication to treat mental illness, you know, depression, anxiety, and that seemed to buy me some more time. And so I started taking 5 different medications, not treating, you know, my sick spirit that I had no idea I had. I bought 3 new cars in 10 years. I didn't know that was a thing. I thought if I could just get a nice car, you know, that would make me feel better. Women, I had a real difficult problem being vulnerable, being emotionally attached. It was very transactional. Again, I could not put myself in a position to get hurt. At this point, my biological father had already passed, and I was dry. And when I got news of this, I can't show up to this funeral. I can't put my sobriety or whatever you want to call it in jeopardy. And so I just avoid it. That's what I do. I avoid and evade. And I end up, you know, I say around, it was 2020. I'm dating a girl at a time and she wants to move to Florida. And I'm scared to lose her at this point. I'm my reliance on people is, you know, if she leaves, I feel lost. So I haven't done anything crazy. Maybe, you know, at this point, I'm still not really feeling too good. Real no purpose in life, kind of just going through the motions. You know, I just need to shake things up. That's what I really thought I was doing. And we decided to move to Florida. And I try to start a little life there. Things get kind of good. You know, I get a really good job at, you know, a career job at Universal Studios as a manager there, and I'm making more money than I ever made, living 5 minutes from Disney with a girl I think I love, and I get all that, and something's still not right. something is still drastically wrong and drastically missing. And if you ask me back then, I don't know. I don't know what's wrong with me. And my girl, she gets hired at Disney, and it's time to celebrate. And all of a sudden, one day after 10 years, it was just a matter of fact. All of a sudden, I get the idea. Maybe I can drink again. You know, I got a good job. Money for the first time is not an issue. I got all these things. I think I can do it again. And I remember going to the bar after 10 years, and I ordered one beer, and I remember thinking instantly that I was signing up for something that I did not want. But the trick for me there was I was able to walk away from that half a beer. I didn't even finish it. I knew it was wrong, and sure enough, it was another attempt for me to try to control and enjoy my drinking like a normal person. And you know, we go out to dinner, two drinks. For some reason, I always wanted to buy a $20 cocktail. Never had a chance to do that. You know, feel like a real grown up. And you know, I had two drinks, and we go home, and I gotta get more. And my girlfriend at the time doesn't understand that. I gotta get more. And you know, once I start, I don't stop. And that's always been my reaction to alcohol. And you know, I'll kind of speed it up a little bit more. I ended up drinking for a year and a half. That's all it took for me. This time when I picked up, it was kind of right where I left off. I did a lot of drinking by myself. I drank in the beginning to connect with people. That's what I always really wanted, to connect to something. I don't know what. I think people, to be honest. But sober around people, I have a very difficult time. And alcohol was able to do that for me. And so this time around, I'm not really drinking, and I didn't really drink out at bars or anything. And the times I did go, you know, I went to Disney. I ended up almost getting arrested at Disney. You know, if I go out to a bar, you know, I end up thinking, you know, the bartender's trying to hook up with my girl. Around people, I can't control the lights. Like, drinking by myself was my only way to control it. And, you know, I remember there was times, you know, I worked nights, so I had a real difficult problem getting out by 2 o'clock to get alcohol, you know. I remember there was one night I was in CVS, and, you know, there's a lady she's exchanging foot lotion at almost 2 o'clock in the morning. And I'm waiting in line with my beer, and I'm just like, please, I just need my beer. It's almost two. And anyway, she ended up taking so long, I couldn't get my beer. And I remember so defeated. I remember even thinking, like, maybe I wasn't meant to drink that night. I remember thinking that. But the next day, I said, I'm never going to get caught not having beer again. And I started bringing my own beer to work. And again, as the drinking progressively got worse, I never wanted to quit, because I knew how miserable it was not to drink. And I think my willpower to make alcohol work in my life kept me drinking at least for another year and a half. I have to be stopped. You know, I have to be, something drastically has to happen, and that's kind of what happened. With me the second time around. I ended up basically getting caught up in some stuff at work, very selfish. It had nothing really to do with alcohol. It was just me seeking attention from other people. And, you know, I was living lies all over. I was living lies at home. I was living lies at work. I was separated from my family. I was alone, and I couldn't be honest with anybody. And I ended up getting fired from my dream job. Again, this whole time I'm pretending like I'm still sober. I got hired there sober, or, you know, 10 or so years dry, and I'm pretending I'm still sober. I remember I ended up getting fired, walked off the property, and my boss, you know, I get escorted out, and he goes, Nick, don't go to the bar. And somehow he knew that's exactly where I was going, and that's exactly what I did. To think of something, I didn't know what I was going to do, and I ended up going to the bar, and I can't go home. I can't go home and tell my girlfriend why I got fired. I can't do that. And so I do what I always do. I avoid and evade. I ended up hunkering down for 3 days in a hotel room, drinking around the clock. Keep, you know, extending this day, scared to death to face my life up at this point. And my girlfriend ends up tracking me down. And at this point, my drinking has destroyed this relationship. I used to schedule our days off. You know, I'd make sure I'd have the day off by myself so I could start drinking in the morning. And it always started with, I'm just going to get sick. For me, that's how it always started with me. I think in the beginning, I had the intentions of getting drunk. But alcohol caused so much problems for me. I just kind of wanted to drink and be okay. I really did. But it always started with six, and I always went back out. Always. And my girlfriend ends up finding me, and she's looking at me, and she's like, I don't know what to do with you. At this point, she's tried to help me, and she's tried to support me. Nick, I'm going to put you on a plane back to Virginia, where you're from, and you should go to rehab. She didn't know what to do with me. And so I knew I was cooked because I had no more sweet promises. I had nothing else to say but okay. I got nothing. And she put me on a plane back to Virginia, and I meet up with my brother. I just have a duffel bag, and you know, the plan was to go to rehab. At this point, I had a little nest egg, and I felt like rehab, they were really interested in my money, and for me, that was enough. To kind of look, I knew about AA. And I go to my first Zoom meeting. It was a noon o'clock Zoom meeting, and I went in there black screen. And a guy says, "Hello, Nick," and I just started spewing. I don't remember what I said. And he puts his number in the chat, and I end up calling him a couple days later, and I end up meeting him at a meeting, my very first meeting. At the Oceanfront, men's meeting Thursday night, Oceanfront. And so I go on my first AA meeting 5 days sober. I remember walking in, instantly feeling welcomed. There was an energy, there was something happening here that I wanted to be a part of. And I want to say the reason I went to AA is because for two things. I knew I couldn't safely drink, again, I can't safely touch this stuff. And number two, whatever I'm doing to not drink is not an option anymore. I exhausted all things possible. I've tried to change myself 1,000 times and failed 1,000 times. I need something different. And that the hopelessness of being just, I had nothing left. That's what got me to AA. And I remember meeting this guy. It was about a room of 60 people. I'm looking for my spot. I remember I introduced myself to the wrong guy, thinking it was the guy I met on Zoom. I remember he was the speaker that night. And one thing that was really weird I remember is he knew everybody in the room. And he, for some reason, sat next to me and talked to me, asked me how I was doing, asked me how many days I had. I remember he asked me how I drank, and I still remember I said, it always starts with six. And again, that was something huge for me. The fact that he took the time to sit down and just see how I was doing, that was enough to get me started. I left that meeting with the big book. I started reading it, I think one day by myself, and I instantly knew. Again, another moment where I know I need to call somebody. This is outside of my nature. I need to call this guy back, and we started getting in the book. The first three chapters for me, I had the it was like finally for me. It was like finally, thank God, it made my life make sense. My reaction to alcohol, you know, why I can never touch it, why I've always had that reaction, the mental obsession, you know, despite everything all my experience I've had with alcohol, all my own power, alcohol will become an option again. And then this idea of a spiritual malady, I never considered that. I remember going through first time with We Agnostics, he kind of asked me, are you willing to believe in something bigger than, I said, of course. I believed alcohol was evil, and I believe it had an evil grip on me. I was willing to believe. I'm willing to try and willing to seek this thing. And it started with simple prayers, real simple. I think the first prayer I memorized was the third step prayer. And I just started again. This is something I've never done or never tried to do. And I'm learning. I'm basically lost on my own power. I need to seek this thing. And I remember, I'll go ahead and kind of speed up a little bit. I will say around month four, I had to go back home to Florida. You know, I had my car there, I had all my stuff there. It was something I was avoiding. If I had a choice, I would have left my car and all my shit in Florida and never talk. I don't like confrontation. I don't like uncomfortability. I avoid and I evade. That's my life. But there was a time where I had to go back home to Florida, and I got my stuff, and I knew I didn't belong there. I knew I needed to come back to Virginia. So I stayed there for a week, and I just packed my stuff. I just started packing my stuff, and I remember leaving. Again, I don't know how I made it through this, but I ended up leaving. And I'm driving back home from Florida, and at this point, I got a little, you know, I'm destroyed. I just broke up with a girlfriend for a four-year relationship. I handled it poorly. I'm just full of emotions. I don't know what to deal with. I'm 4 years or 4 months sober. I'm driving back from Florida. At this point, I kind of have an idea. You know, Nick, if you have the urge to drink, it's a good idea to call somebody. I didn't do that. At this point, I knew I started developing a little bit of prayer life. I remember thinking, I was convincing myself I'm going to drink. I know the feelings I'm feeling right now. I know what will fix that right away, and I'm willing to start over. I just need to fix this, and I made a decision in my head that I'm going to drink, and I end up, again, for whatever reason, I decided to ask God to remove the obsession to drink alcohol. I said a prayer on my own, and I remember not feeling any different about it. I remember still convinced that I was going to get drunk tonight, and it was about midnight in South Carolina, and I couldn't find a gas. I pulled over, and I couldn't find a gas station open. I drove by five gas stations that were all closed, and I pulled in to my Econ Lodge, I believe, or a cheap hotel. And I pull in there, and I remember thinking, maybe there is something protecting me. Maybe there is something to this. Maybe there is something protecting me. That's all I gotta do is seek this thing. And so I got back to Florida, and I just took off like a rocket after having that experience. But the next 10 months, I sat on the inventory. I don't recommend doing that. I slowly, again, I go to a ton of meetings. I still go to a lot of meetings, but I wasn't willing to do what I believe is one of the first my first attempt to treat the spiritual malady that I have. I tried the physical stuff. I've tried the mental stuff. I had never attempted to treat my spirit and my sick spirit. And this was difficult for me. I was scared it wasn't going to work. I was scared I had to be perfect. But what ended up happening was I ended up doing a lot of things besides that fourth step. I became a GSR. I started going to the VAC. I joined a home group with only two members, and I just said yes to stuff, and I started showing up. I went to my first VAC at 6 months sober. Again, I was invited. I had no good excuse to not go, so I went. And I just started saying yes to everything but the inventory. And I had my, and I remember that weekend, it was the longest couple of days where I was not obsessively thinking about myself. I mean, at this point, my mind is insane. Just thinking about all the things I need to do and, you know, getting all my, everything, all my duckies in a row. But that weekend was the first time I was not thinking about myself. And I remember thinking there might be something to that. There might be a reason 300 people look so free in this room. That was attractive to me. And I remember thinking, you know, each one of these guys got a white chip at one point, you know, and it gave me hope, like maybe there is a life here for me. And again, that bought me some time. I started going, you know, tagging along to treatment center visits and things like that. That bought me a little time. But there, I got to a point where I was leaving meetings feeling worse. I'm starting to feel a part of, again, you guys were so welcome to me. I was starting to feel a part of. I was in a room full of AA, or AA meeting, and just the room is loud. And then there's me, and I'm like, please, someone better come up and say hello to me. You got 5 seconds. And I'm starting to separate myself. Again, what I always do, whether I'm drinking or I'm not drinking, I push people away. I had to get the inventory done, or I was going to drink. I was at this point starting to consider maybe I need a new rock bottom, or maybe I need to suffer a little bit more to get me into moving into action. I'm glad that there was people in the fellowship that helped me get this done, and I finally get the inventory done, and I realize, you know, the value in it. You know, this is a good attempt at basically my life's, how I operate, really. I realize all my resentments are people, everybody that's close to me. And that's kind of, it's interesting to think, because I will begin to get resentful just being around you long enough. That is just my nature. And all my life, the way I dealt with resentments is, I would just avoid you, or I would just cut you out. That's how I live life. Whether I did something shameful or I felt hurt or stepped on, I would just cut you out. And again, I desperately want to connect. I desperately want to. And I take a good look at my side, and I realize, you know, my dishonesty and how I manipulate, and how do I I come out of the inventory, you know, realizing a couple things. For once, the step three kind of comes together for me. I realize why my life on self-will doesn't work. I look at it and I'm killing myself. And it's all me. It's all me. It has nothing to do with outside circumstances. And I didn't understand that. I thought if I can just treat you right, my boss, for instance, and just butter you up, you're going to butter me up, and everything's going to be perfect. I thought I can change people by my actions. I had it all backwards. I don't have the power to change people. So I finally get through the fifth, and I get out a little freer. I come out a little freer. Let's see. And then I did that around my year mark, and I got a little relief out of that, and I kind of just started coasting a little bit. And I remember calling my sponsor and saying, you know, I don't want to do any. It's time to get on the amends, and I don't really want to do any of the amends. And he goes, he says, Nick, you don't have to do any of this if you don't want to. And I said one thing. I remember I was like, I'm not quite free yet. I'm still. It's still not enough. And so right now I got done 3 or 4 of my amends. I still need to continue going. I will just kind of just briefly share some of my experiences with amends. The ability to show up voluntarily to admit my wrong is something huge for me. Every time I admitted my wrong, it was to extend or exceed or further a selfish end. It's the only time I ever really admitted my wrong. So this practice of showing up voluntarily to try to repair a relationship. My first one was my dad. I ended up, when my mom passed, I had my mom's credit card, and for about a week, I went around town spending, after she died, spending some money. And this is something I just walked around with all my life. You know, I was like in the room everywhere, and I finally was able to get down, sit down in front of my dad and get clean of this stuff. And I remember my sponsor telling me, there's gonna be a point where you're just gonna need to shut up. And that's exactly what happened. I let him kind of talk, let him get free of some things, and we have a great relationship today. And I had a couple of my aunts, again, a lot of it's family. A lot of it was surrounding my mom's death. Again, through the whole process, the amends I've made, one thing that has been clear for me is my delusion, or what I thought was really going on, is completely wrong. My reality was so warped in terms of what was really going on. Again, it was all centered around me and how it was affecting me and my problems, and I never really considered other people. So as of today, I'm getting some traction on some. I'm gonna head to my dad's side is my next. That's where I'm gonna be heading, to my dad's side of the family. Because again, I never went to the funeral. I just X'd everybody out of my life. But the beauty of learning how to write inventory, and again working through that and understanding what the things I'm looking for. I'll kind of just share on 2-10 steps that I normally, again, it was about 7 or 8 months sober. I had my first real life fresh resentment in sobriety with my brother. I started working with my brother, and basically he ended up, in my eyes, 1099ing me. Excuse me. And I was real burnt up about that, and I remember calling my sponsor, and he said, Nick, this is a good opportunity to do a 10 step. And at this point, I didn't even write my inventory yet. And I remember he was like, Nick, this is the program. This is what we do. It's not going to a ton of meetings. It's again learning this practice of writing inventory. And very quickly, I was able to realize where I was dishonest. That fourth column. I didn't really, again, I thought I got special treatment. He's my brother. He's going to pay me under the table. I didn't really ask any questions. I do that on purpose. I kind of just pretend like it's not happening. So I realized, again, where I kind of put myself in a position to get hurt. And the important thing for me is that process is avoiding retaliation. Because I have a tendency to let things bubble up, and I end up making a fool out of myself. That's usually how I do it. And another 10 step that's pretty, again, the process of writing inventory. My coworker, I ended up getting the wrong check one morning, and I realized this new guy is getting paid more than me. And I was burned up, and I don't, you guys tell me that this stuff will kill me, this stuff will keep me sick, this stuff will keep me isolated and not useful. And I remember I wrote it out, and And again, that fourth column, I realize, you know, I take a look at my own inadequacies. I realize maybe this guy, I'm not a good interviewer. I just say yes to pay, or again, I get free of that. And you know, it's been almost a year since I wrote an inventory in him, and every morning we read touchstones together. Every morning, this turned into a great friend for me, great coworker, I don't have the ability or the capability to forget or wish a resentment away. I need help, and then that process seems to help me out. I started learning, you know, I started practicing the 11th step. It's a practice that I continue to try and do. You know, for me, I've always, again, my craving for connection has been all my life. I'm desperate for it, and I don't know where to connect. And the 11 step instructions, you know, really specific. You know, you know, there's moments throughout the day where I have opportunities to pray if I'm willing to look at them. You know, if I'm doubtful, agitated, these are opportunities to pray. And again, it's a practice of trying and continuing to seek. And again, to remind myself that, you know, this isn't my show anymore. To please be helpful, to try to be helpful. I need help to be helpful. You know, that step, that seems to, again, it's a practice that I continue to try daily. I try to, let's see. I try my best to, you know, to help others in terms of step 12, to carry the message. You know, I think simple hospitality and a warm welcome can go a long way. You know, I know what it did for me. For me, it's just like practice. Sitting down in front of a newcomer for coffee. You know, it takes practice for me. I realize if I'm sitting down with a new guy, the importance, you know, of, you know, reliance. Self-reliance, and I think I'm running out of steam here. I will say today, I'm in a completely different field of work. I'm starting brand new. In construction, which is scary, but I believe today, you know, on the footing of AA, as a centerpiece of my life, I think I'm free to walk, you know, wherever I do whatever I want to do. I'm very grateful for the opportunity to come share with you guys, and I think that's all I got.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks again, Dave. Okay, seventh tradition states that every AA group be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. Money collected at this meeting covers donation to the church and supplies. The rest is given to the Tidewater Intergroup, District 24, in the General Services Office. Are there any AA-related announcements?
Check the dog, Paul.
Hey, Jay.
The last Friday of April, which I believe is the 25th.